This is the Blaze Radio On Demand.
The founder of this company 10 years ago was trying to sell his house. He's, you know, he's kind of an important guy. And he said to his wife, if this is what it's like for us, how do people who have no clout ever get around this? So he started a company and it went into business, I think, 3 years ago. Their deal is, their word is their bond. And they are people that listen to the show. They are just like you. Now, how can I say that? Because I'm the founder of the company. RealEstateAgentsITrust.com.
Now, spreading freedom across the nation, this is 3, 2, 1.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome to the Freedom Hut. Thank you for joining. Great to have you as always. I am coming to you live from Dallas today. RNC day 4 is upon us. Tonight is the big night when Donald Trump will give his speech. And I suppose we're going to see some momentum coming out of this going forward into the general election. At least that is the idea. Now, before I get into my sense of things today, a few moments of prefacing, a little bit of context, a little bit of background. I think that's only fair. Some of you are going to disagree with me today, and that's fine. That is fine. I don't come to you with my thoughts on this, suggesting that I'm right, you're wrong, for those of you who will think that I'm wrong. I'm just telling you what I think, trying to make a case to you. That's just where I am. And with that in mind, I wanted to say a few things before. Others, by the way, I think will agree with me. It really, really depends. But I have a feeling that there's going to be somewhat sharp disagreement here. And it's fine. I like that I feel comfortable being able to say things to you that I know will not necessarily be what many or even a majority or most of you want to hear from me when it comes to my sense of how a certain thing is going from within our party. That's fine, because I don't pretend to have all the answers about what's going on right now. I don't know what the future is going to be. I also am honest in telling you that nobody knows what the future is going to be. And be very cautious whenever someone tells you that they think they can predict the future. Usually they are wrong, and they're just telling you that so that they can get you to believe something or do something now. With that in mind, I just also want to say that I just don't pander. It's not something that I will do. It's antithetical to the very basic premise of the show, which is an open and continuous conversation with all of you about whatever is interesting, whatever matters, whatever is fun, whatever is worthwhile going on in the world, in the past. That's what I do here. That's what we all do. Okay. So, and I can't pander, by the way, because I would just lose my mind having to continue to say something that I don't believe. I just couldn't do it. So let me just get another thing out of the way. I watched the Cruz and Pence speeches last night. I don't think I watched any others in full, but I watched Cruz and I watched Pence. And in fact, I watched the Cruz speech twice just to make sure that I kind of got all of what was going on there and didn't miss anything. So here's what I have to say about that. First, the Mike Pence speech was competent. Better than competent, actually. It was solid. It was not particularly memorable, but I think it served its purpose. It was good, certainly good enough. It was all it needed to be. And you saw a very sober and serious and earnest individual on stage last night, I thought, with Mike Pence. At least that's how it came off in the speech. If some of you want to talk about how he sort of wanted touchback amnesty and you think he's not who he says he is, whatever, we can do that another time. But in terms of how the speech came across to me, and with speeches, with politics, when we're talking about politics, the way it seems matters a lot, right? The perception is sometimes the same thing, really, as the reality, because if enough people believe that a politician came across a certain way, then it serves that purpose. All right. So that's the Pence side of things. Then we had the Ted Cruz speech, and I'm sure you all know now, you've probably watched the speech, been talking about it a little bit today. In case you didn't, there was, he went on for a while, I think it was about a 25 or 30 minute long speech, And it was a classic Ted Cruz, speech. He talked a lot about freedom and about what makes America great. Pardon me, that was a slip. But I mean, you know, he talked about freedom and he talked about a whole bunch of issues, told sort of a little bit of his family history. His father came to America, $100 sewn into his underwear. It was a very classic, solid Ted Cruz speech. But of course, Ted Cruz was speaking at the Republican National Convention. He's speaking at the RNC. And well, there were a lot of people who were wondering whether or not he would go forward and endorse or at least lend his support to Donald Trump as the nominee. Donald Trump is now officially the Republican nominee. As you know, there's not any, oh, maybe, sort of, there's something else. No, Donald Trump is officially the nominee. Okay. So what do we do about that? And Ted Cruz went forward and said that at sort of the key moment where I think people were assuming that he would say even something like we have to defeat Hillary Clinton. I mean, I you know, this is, there's a lot of straw men that are out there right now for people who, who are arguing the side of things that everything Ted Cruz did last night was brilliant and wonderful and it was genius and he loves the Constitution and he loves America. And that all very well may be true. But I do think that we need to be completely honest about the circumstances, the situation, and what really happened. There's a difference between groveling or being, I think, as Cruz says later on, a sort of a puppy that does whatever it's told, and saying, look, we've just got to defeat Hillary Clinton. Take that for whatever it's worth. Right. I mean, there was a way to say support the nominee without saying I formally endorse Donald Trump. And Ted Cruz didn't do that. And that resulted in some booing. Let's play clip two. It's just sort of a lot of noise. Sorry,
appreciate the enthusiasm of the New York delegation. We must make the most of our moment to fight for freedom, to protect our God-given rights, even of those with whom we don't agree. We will unite the party. We will unite the country by standing together for shared values, by standing for liberty. God bless each and every one of you, and God bless the United States of America.
There's an important line that we didn't include. You can hear there's a lot of booing there. Look, Ted Cruz came into to people standing and cheering across the board, and then, of course, at the end, there are people who were booing. He said, vote your conscience, which is, well, for those who are saying, oh, but, you know, he didn't criticize Trump and he said unite the party. Vote your conscience when you have only two options is, well, let's think about that for a second. What could that mean? You're speaking to a room full of Republicans, maybe not all conservatives, but people that are a part of the GOP. So you're going to tell everybody in the GOP, vote your conscience. Okay, fine. That's, you know. That's like when somebody asks you if they just cooked you a big dinner. How was the food? You said it was interesting. That's not saying it's bad, but it's not saying it's good either. And people will make inferences from that. Now, I know there's a lot of people out there right now who are telling me, and I get all the heat and I understand. I would just ask them, because there's like, well, Buck, well, what about this? And Ted Cruz, and he's amazing, and he's freedom, and the party, and the principles, and the future. For one, I think everyone should be very cautious and very slow to lecture their fellow conservatives about principle when, for example, I mean, I'm somebody who only backed one candidate openly before this in the primary, and it was Ted Cruz. And did my best under difficult circumstances because the media did not want Ted Cruz to really have much time to make his argument publicly. Did my best to make the case for Ted Cruz in hostile territory time and time again. I was chironed, as I say in the business, which is when they sort of put that little writing at the bottom of the screen, you know, Ted Cruz supporter. I was still being called a Ted Cruz supporter when Ted Cruz was no longer going to be in the race. So I get it. I don't need anyone to lecture me on principles or constitutionalism. I mean, that's if somebody wants to do that, that's, you know, that's their prerogative, but it's useless. And honestly, it's a little, it's just a little annoying. It's a little arrogant. I'm fully aware of both all of the gifts that Ted Cruz has and what he stands for. Not just aware, I supported it openly. I defended Ted Cruz publicly. I put my own reputation and name on the line alongside his as best I could. Now, look, I don't have a platform as large as many others, but I am able to go on national TV and talk about these things to people, and I did what I could for the Cruz cause when it was a cause. Here's the problem. There isn't a Cruz cause right now. There is a presidential election. We have Hillary Clinton or we have Donald Trump. That's it. And I know people say, I don't like the binary choice, Buck. I don't like it. I know I don't like it either. I think this kind of stinks across the board. I mean, this is what I do for a living, and professionally, looking at elections, looking at politics and policies. It's what I do all day long. And it just burns my butt that I have to sit here and deal with the fact that I have a nominee that, yeah, it is a close call in some ways between Trump and Hillary. But it's not a call where I have any confusion. I go Trump over Hillary. And I don't feel good about it. I'm not excited about it. But I also recognize what the reality of a Hillary Clinton presidency would be. And if you stand for conservative principles and you love the values and the policies that could enact those values or protect them, even more to the point, you have to also live in the real world and deal with the system we have and understand that there is an election underway here. If the Republican National Convention is not about uniting behind the Republican nominee, what's the point, everybody? What's the point? The point is for setting up the party for the future for 2020. That's not why they're having this big gathering, this big party, this big whatever it is, symposium, whatever you want to call it. The point's not to unite behind a nominee. I don't see what else the point could really be. And so was last night helpful? This is how I view it. Was last night helpful to that cause or not? I don't think that it was. And if we're at a point now where we're so disgusted by Trumpism that we don't even want to support the Republican nominee at the Republican convention, let's not have a convention and let's just all say we give Hillary wins. We'll rebound for this. We'll rebound for 2020. Let's just be honest about that. That's really where we are. Is that where we are? I don't know. It seemed like it from what I gathered from a lot of people last night. That this was great. It was brilliant. The Republic has been saved. Okay. So we prefer Hillary then. And I know people don't like that choice and they think it's simplistic and it's childish, but yet there is no answer to it. Or what? We're gonna vote for Gary Johnson? And I haven't even gotten into, by the way, the pledge. And, you know, we'll talk a little bit more about all of that, too. But you see, I feel like there are others who must agree with me out there just because I'm talking to a lot of people right now. And I don't begrudge people that are grossed out by the – I'm with you. That's what I'm with you on all this. But I'm just horrified at the prospect of a Hillary Clinton presidency. Horrified. This woman should be criminally prosecuted. This woman is so corrupt, you don't even know where to start. You think if you stand for life, if you stand for the family, if you stand for Americanism, if you think this is a great country and that we're not all sort of the same country, and if you think that Western civilization has meaning, if you think that we're under assault from jihadists all over the world, go down the list. If you think that the government doesn't have a right to just take your property and give it to others, I mean, Hillary Clinton will destroy all of those things for you, or rather will go against you on all of those things, every single one. And if you want to tell me that Trump's going to do exactly the same thing, fine, let's go with Hillary. Let's just go with Hillary. I don't, what else is there to say? And you know, I can do that, by the way. I could come in with you. day in and day out and have a fantastic show and not talk about the election. We could talk about what's going on in the world. We could talk about policies here at home. We could talk about narratives and the media. I mean, we don't really, and I don't do that much of it. And I think you all know why. Because my heart's really not that into the whole yay, yay Trump thing at all. That's obvious. But I also try to be realistic about what the implications are of a Hillary Clinton presidency. And, you know, I'm kind of willing to eat my peas on this one. That doesn't mean I'm abandoning principle. And this is what do principles mean if you don't actually do anything for them? If we're talking about a presidential election, all you can do is push your ideas out there and vote, right? You do it. I do it. We all do it. Talk to our neighbors, our friends, maybe get on social media. We push ideas and we vote. And we try to do the best we can under the circumstances to get the best policies we can that are as close to being in line with what we believe and what we don't. That's it. That's all. All right. We got more. I mean, I expect there to be some phone calls on this today, if I may be so bold. Please. I want to hear it. If you agree with me, I want to hear it. If I'm wrong, I want to hear it. You guys are my family. We can talk about this. Let's do it. I need to know why people think that was such a great thing right now for the Republican Party. I need someone to help me understand. And if I really think I'm wrong after the end of the conversation, I will say that too. 888-900-3393. Sponsor this half hour is My Patriot Supply. Listen, team, there's one thing we all can agree on. Preparedness is essential no matter where you are. Just 4 years ago, I saw Hurricane Sandy knock out power for millions in New York City. Grid by grid, block by block, darkness fell over the entire city. Grocery stores didn't know if they were going to have shortages, when the next deliveries would come. Look, you don't want to get caught in that situation. Our friends at My Patriot Supply will make sure you're prepared with food no matter what happens. Right now, they're giving you a special buy one, get one free offer on their two-week emergency food supply. Just buy one two-week food supply for $117, and they'll ship a second one free. Your emergency food supply stores easily and lasts up to 25 years. Take action now. Call 888-394-1029 or online at preparewithbuck.com, 888-394-1029, or online at preparewithbuck.com. Team, we've got a lot more. Stay with me.
Buck Sexton, dispensing the truth.
On the Blaze Radio Network.
What's up, Team Buck? Have you ever tried a Casper mattress? They are incredible. Casper is an obsessively engineered mattress at an incredibly fair price. It combines springy latex and supportive memory foams to create an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink and the perfect amount of bounce. Time magazine named it as one of the best inventions of 2015. In fact, it's now the most awarded mattress of the decade. You get free shipping and returns to the U.S. and Canada, and you can try it free for 100 nights, risk-free, in your own home. And if you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. It's made right here in America. All you have to do is go to Casper.com/buck. That's www.casper.com/buck. You can get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting Casper.com/buck. Terms and conditions apply. This is an incredible mattress at a fantastic price. You can get it now via this deal. Check it out.
You're listening to the Buck Sexton Show, only on the Blaze Radio Network.
All right, if you're on hold, we'll get to you in a few because we don't have too much time right here, right now, before we get into the next break. We're also going to have my friend Steve Yates, the chairman of the Idaho Republican Party, obviously also a former senior advisor. He was deputy national security advisor to Dick Cheney, so guy who knows politics very, very well. I think he's one of the perfect combinations, or one of the best combinations out there, of highly knowledgeable and highly reasonable. And I don't know what he's going to say. So just, you know, I haven't sort of coordinated with Steve before, and I'm curious to kind of get his sense of things. He's a guy who both is very conservative. I mean, Steve Yates is as conservative as anybody I know, but also understands what it means to try to win and try to work with the reality of what you've got. Look, it kind of bums me out when I see some people telling me that they can't, you know, that they're so upset at me over this. Okay, what? I just want someone to tell me what the answer is. Stay home? Write in? I'd like a better answer. I want a better answer. Oh, and also a quick note on this. I'm aware of the fact that the remarks were, as I understand it at least, is what's been reported by a lot of different outlets, given to the Trump campaign beforehand. And that Trump did obviously come in a sort of WWE style, like, you know, step on the ending for the Cruz speech, and that it looked like they were kind of getting people to boo. And maybe I totally believe that maybe the Trump campaign miscalculated and thought that this was a way to kind of, you know, put egg on Cruz's face, you know, to sort of make him look bad. But why would Cruz? What's the point from Cruz's side of things? Why play in? Why do all that? To give a speech about conservatism and principle with the hopes of what? Running in 2020? Okay, if that's what people think was the great thing about last night, well, let's just talk about that. But then also, let's just say, we're done with the election. Hillary wins. 2020, Ted Cruz. We want to talk about that? We can do that, but let's just do it. Back in a few.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network. The Buck Sexton Show.
Joined now by Stephen Yates. He is the chairman of the Idaho Republican Party. He is at the convention. He's going to lay it all down straight for us. Steve, always great to have you. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you, Buck. Great to be with you.
All right, Steve. So what's the mood like? What's the vibe after yesterday?
Well, obviously a few things happened last night that got everyone's attention.
A couple, yeah.
I would say that. Yeah. Well, I'd say the biggest disappointment I have is that it was the reaction to the end of Ted Cruz's speech that has dominated a lot of what people have been thinking and talking about, and to an extent that really looks past what I thought was an amazingly effective speech by Mike Pence. It was his reintroduction to the country and the world. He really had a lot of things in there that were, I thought, really strong stylistically and substantively. And his self-introduction of being a Christian first, a conservative second, and a Republican third in that order, that's something that really resonates with a lot of people in the arena, I suspect, with a lot of people around the country.
But what's the I agree with you, by the way, that Pence was very effective and also, unfortunately, was overshadowed by what happened with the Cruz speech. But, you know, you're around, their delegates are there, and what are people talking about? How much support is there, at least at the RNC, from what you're gathering, for Cruz's non-endorsement? It was a non-endorsement. I think that's an accurate description of it. There was no endorsement given. He did speak a lot
that's
about
right.
conservative principles and freedom and all sorts of great things, but there was no endorsement. What's the response like?
Well, I can just say from the people who were in my delegation, which were 20 delegates for Cruz and 12 for Trump. We had the Colorado delegation behind us that was very strongly for Cruz and Texas delegation to our side. There were a lot of Texas delegation members that were extremely angry about it, and they were expressing their views pretty bluntly, and they basically felt like you make a pledge, you stick to your pledge, you come to someone's nominating convention, and you're not ready to nominate, maybe you shouldn't have come to the convention and taken your time to speak. Now, of course, all this stuff is legal and allowed and all of that, but there were a lot of people that were really put off by the idea of coming and taking a lot of prime time, and then in the end, not getting to those magic words, because really almost everyone at convention believes it's vital to defeat Hillary, and Senator Cruz made a great case against Hillary, all those principles that are at stake, they just seem to miss that last step, and that's why we cannot possibly allow the Clintons back in the White House for another 4, much less 8 years.
I mean, you're a guy, Steve, who works in politics. You're chairman of the Idaho State GOP. What's the purpose of the convention if not to gather around a nominee to defeat Hillary? I don't really. There's a whole tonight. What's the crowning moment, so to speak? Perhaps crowning moment is not the best choice of words here, but you know the high point of this is all supposed to be when the nominee addresses the American people. It's not when people sit around and talk about down ballot races. Would you agree with the contention that this is about unifying behind a nominee? If that's not what it's about, I would love an explanation from you, from someone whose judgment and character I really trust, on what is this really about then?
No, I think you're exactly right. And I think that's one of the more frustrating and disappointing things about what Senator Cruz chose to do. I've liked him personally. I've had people close to me who have worked for his campaign and invested in him as a leader. But really, if our system is going to function, you have to honor the will of the voters, even when the voters may not have the wisdom to go the way you think they should. And if you have hope of a nomination in the future, there may be people out there then that feel the way you do now, and you need them to rally and support you against what I consider to be the greater problem, the greater challenge to the fundamental principles. And so it's maybe a major process foul, and a lot of Americans say, well, big whoop, it's a process foul. But it's a big deal. It's a big deal because I think a lot of us, we went through a competitive primary process. It's tiring. We're ready to really take it after Hillary and the Democrats and just get this done. I do think tonight probably is going to have good star quality and production value. The messages this week have really been strong and inspiring in a lot of ways. And it was, I think, a real unfortunate downer for a lot of us as delegates to have that play out the way it did. I mean, why do you want to have a cascading shower of boos for a guy that a lot of people in our country liked up until that point? And, you know, for his sake and for those who really are dedicated supporting him, I hope that they pick up and move on and can help. And I hope the people who are offended by it can pick up and move on and help, because really what it's all about is getting our principles out there with the best chance to move forward. And it's a binary choice. It's going to be Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, and it's not hard for me to choose at this point.
What do you say to those? I see so much fighting against this, including from a lot of conservative writers and activists and people that, you know, this is what they do. This is what they care about. This is sort of the air they breathe, the water in which they swim. Who say, well, they don't like the binary. They don't like this whole, oh, it's a binary choice. I kind of just want to always say, but it is a binary choice. So, it's sort of like saying, well, everyone can stay home and not vote, and, you know, who's a conservative, and then Hillary Clinton will win. I mean, that's totally each individual's choice to do that. But it does mean that Hillary Clinton will win. This is reality. I don't know why there's this effort to sort of pretend that it's not reality. There's no other reality that I'm aware of. Is there a third option? I mean, what, no. Gary Johnson? I mean, come on.
No, there's no, you can twist it in terms of how to talk about it and think about it. But in the famous philosophical text known as Highlander, the movie, in the end, there can only be one. There is only one person who emerges from this. And so you don't really get a chance of saying, here's someone who's going to come in a distant third, but I really like him and I didn't want to cast a ballot for these others. People, look, they have a choice not to vote for the office of president. That's their right. I hope people exercise their rights, but what they don't get to choose is what the effect of that choice is on the outcome. And this is politics in the end is a game of numbers. One team's going to put up a certain number of points in the form of electoral college votes, and the other is going to have a competing number. There is no scenario in which the Libertarian candidate is going to rally maybe even a single electoral vote. And so everything that goes to, it's going to go either red or blue on that map. And I don't know how anyone in good conscience can say, well, we just need to cleanse the palate for 4 or 8 years with Hillary Clinton until we can get a better Republican nominee in their point of view. And ultimately, it's an extreme disrespect to millions and millions of voters. I may not have agreed with primary voters on where they were trending earlier in this process, but it is the process. If you're going to be in it, you got to honor the outcome and move forward and try to make it as best as it possibly can be, in my point of view. But I come at it from a party chairman point of view.
Yeah, but you see what the effects of elections are, and there are consequences to elections. I mean, as much as it's nice to talk about principles and constitutionalism, and to be consistent and not to fall into a sort of hypocrisy over what we support and what we believe. That's all well and good. There is a binary choice ahead of us. It's not one that I particularly relish. I'm not really enjoying this season, this general election season, as much as I might have otherwise. I openly and on the record backed Cruz to the greatest extent that I possibly could. And I don't understand the vitriol that, quite honestly, you're seeing from a lot of people against those who don't. I don't understand what the purpose of last night to reaffirm principles. I mean, Ted Cruz has a big platform. He can reaffirm principles whenever he wants, which brings me to this notion of the pledge. Okay, Trump said gross things about Cruz's, or he retweeted something about Cruz's wife, and he said something preposterous about Cruz's dad. I get all of that. But look, if I were in a primary campaign against somebody like a Donald Trump, I think I just would have said I'm not necessarily going to back the final nominee. I mean, I don't know what else to say. I mean, I think a contract is a contract.
Well, and that's kind of the way a large number of delegates felt. I mean, that reaction in the arena. We had some spicy points on Monday when there were process votes, and it gave you a good feel for what the breakdown was in terms of Cruz versus Trump and RNC, other kinds of delegates were in the room. It was loud. You could kind of sense where the energy was, what their numbers were. That cascade of boos was not limited to just Trump supporters. That cascade of boos was thunderous, and it had to have included some of the delegates that were fundamentally disappointed with what Cruz said. Those very words were part of the mantra of the Unbind movement that was specifically designed to try to move the nomination to a different candidate, one who had received many, many, many fewer votes, if any votes, in the primary process. And so, it's one of those decisions. He's a grown-up. He made a choice. He made a choice when he made the pledge. He made a choice when he accepted the invitation to speak in prime time. And he made a choice to echo that sentiment right at the end of what otherwise was an eloquent, principled speech. And if he had just put the words at the end, he didn't have to say, "I love Donald Trump." All he had to say was, "For all of these reasons, it's vital that all of America goes to the ballot in November and votes for the Republican nominee." That would have been a half measure, but it would have been in the right direction, would have been totally defensible, and he'd still be really strong, probably would have had a standing ovation instead of a shower of boos.
Yeah, well, that's where I am on this, too. No one's saying that he had to be a servile puppy, in Cruz's words. He didn't have to say Donald Trump is a great constitutionalist. I love him. He's awesome. He's dignified. He's wonderful. He could have just said, "Vote to beat Hillary." The end. Thanks, everybody. Standing ovation. You know, I mean, the message would have been clear. Yeah. I mean, I don't think that he has to self-flagellate on stage in front of all of us. I think that it's enough for him to just say, "You know, look, we got to beat Hillary, guys. This stinks, but we're going to do it." But instead, he got up there at an event, the whole purpose of which is to unify the Republican Party behind a nominee and say, "Vote your conscience," which was just, I mean, come on. People will tell me that's not a swipe at the nominee. I mean, let's all be grown-ups here. That means, yeah, maybe vote for Trump, maybe don't.
That's right. And it basically is a judgment, in some people's assessment, against those of us who are delegates who believe that our conscience says we can't allow the country to fall into Hillary's hands. It's a judgment against us who believe our conscience says we had millions and millions and millions of more voters in our nominating process this year than we've had in past cycles. And at this late stage, to turn our backs on that outcome is questionable morally and process-wise to a lot of people. I know that there are those who disagree with those sentiments, but by stating it in that way, it comes across as kind of passing judgment that I'm holier than the rest of you, and I think that's not helpful to Senator Cruz. I had hoped for more from him. I hope for more from him in the future, but I really think that last night might have been really damaging to him.
I agree with, and I told everybody, Steve, you and I hadn't even exchanged so much as a text message before you came on today. I didn't know where you were going to come. Yeah, see, you can listen to Steve. I didn't know where he was going to come down on this issue. I'm getting a lot of heat from people, even though I was a Cruz supporter. I'm getting a lot of heat from the Cruz supporters on this. And I'm like, guys, now you've got somebody who's a chairman of a state GOP from a state that went predominantly for Cruz, actually. telling you that a lot of people that are have been a part of this process were very unhappy with what happened last night, including people who had supported Cruz to the best of their ability all along. So that's kind of where we are. Steve, look, I know you're super busy and you're at the convention. Really appreciate you giving us a ring. Stephen Yates, Idaho GOP chairman and also former Deputy National Security Advisor to Dick Cheney and also D.C. International Advisors chairman and founder. Stephen, great to have you.
Thank you, Buck. Take care.
Take care. All right, team. We'll take some calls back in a few.
Buck Sexton.
The Blaze Radio Network. The Buck Sexton Show.
I said we take some calls. Let's get them going here. 888-900-3393. I see a lot of opinions online about this. I'd love to hear some on air. John in North Carolina, what's up?
Yeah, I had originally called in about the you omitting the fact that Trump sent out his little posse to get the whole thing started up.
I didn't omit it. I just didn't get it. I got to it as quickly as I could. There's a lot going on, but go ahead.
Okay, well, when I called, It was left out of the original, and I lost a bit of audio. I heard you come back in and say something about it. But the thing is, there's all these calls for unity, and the one person who doesn't seem to get the call for unity is Trump himself. Trump did that himself. If he would have not drummed up those people, there's a good possibility that that booing section would not have happened. He had people down there actively generating that stuff. So,
no, I think the Trump campaign may have, from the Trump coming in at the end to approving the speech, it was sort of like a WWE moment where, you know, like the wrestler appears and it's like boo and yay, you know, all that. But why would Cruz want to be a part of that then? That's what I don't know. He didn't have to speak. I mean, I don't know why everyone's saying, oh, well, he was invited. Okay, he could have said no.
Nothing that Cruz said in that speech detracted from Donald Trump one bit. This is the fantasy. You get something drummed up by Trump, and then it turns around and it's somebody else's fault all the time from this guy. He's had multiple chances to try to get conservatives to come to his side, and he's squandered every one of them, or actually just stuck you in the eye. Now, you know, at some point he's got to be held accountable for what he's doing, not just everybody else.
That's a fair point. I wish Trump would do a better job of uniting the party, too. There's no question. I wish he would do better outreach and more inclusive. But, you know, I don't know. I don't know what to say. I don't have the answers. People get mad at me. I don't have the answers. I just know what I saw last night and what I think is the best way forward for the Republican Party. But maybe I'm wrong. Who knows? John, I do appreciate the call. Team, we've got more. Back in a few.
You're listening to Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network. Spreading freedom across the nation. This is
the Buck Sexton Show.
All right, team, welcome back to the Freedom Hut. Phone line still open, 888-900-3393. We're joined by Adam Credo. He is of the Washington Free Beacon. He is at the convention. Adam, thanks for calling in.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
What are we expecting for tonight? Give me some ground truth, some ground level view of what's happening and what people are talking about going into the what's supposed to be the biggest night of the RNC.
This is without a doubt the biggest night, and you could even feel it last night, I think, too. And you're probably seeing what I'm seeing, the nonstop talk about Ted Cruz and his comments. That's on everybody's lips. I'm hearing it from everybody I walk into. It is the story, and it probably will continue to be, because how is Trump going to respond? Trump does not stay silent about this, I don't think. He's not that kind of guy. So how's he go back after? How's he push another jab out there?
Now, you have Trump speaking out. You also have Ivanka, his daughter, right? And anyone else that's supposed to be that sort of expected to be electrifying that auditorium and perhaps people at home in one way or another?
Well, look, I mean, obviously we're looking forward to the bigger speeches of the night. I'll be perfectly honest with you. I'll give you a little truth bomb right now. I think it's a crapshoot with a lot of the speeches. They're often hit or miss for me personally, but I'd also say I look for particular things, the foreign policy angle, and oftentimes that's missing for many of these speeches.
Now, from various conservative journalists and pundits and opinion makers over there, do people feel like the convention has been useful? Is it bringing people together? What's sort of the takeaway at this point?
Well, look, if the large question is unity, did we foster unity? That was a big theme for the party. I'm not sure that happened. And if there was an air of that, it's certainly been completely erased after last night. If you're talking from a business perspective, political, getting things done, that's not happening inside the convention hall. That's happening on the periphery at all these wonderful events that people are hosting and having all the reporters and media people out. That's where I think a lot of the real talk goes down.
Now, I also want to switch gears for a second, Adam. You're a guy who focuses on national security. We've been talking a lot of politics already on the show, but since you're at the convention, definitely sure. Wanted to get your feel on that. Give me some of the details on this Iran side deal, which, by the way, has been completely overshadowed in the news cycle because of all the political stuff going on, both the Black Lives Matter, the terrorist attacks overseas, and the political stories. What is this sort of secret side Iran deal that people have realized is there, but isn't really seeming to capture the public imagination much?
It really has been overshadowed, and I can't emphasize enough how much of a major news story this is. Look, we had from lawmakers in Congress since the start of diplomacy and negotiations with Iran, people hinting that the administration was being sneaky, that it was lying not just to the American public, but lawmakers. And we saw in that pro-Iran echo chamber article that the New York Times published another bombshell in this. But now we actually have a document. We have paper, an official document that shows the Obama administration essentially consenting to an Iranian research and development plan. What is that? That means that restrictions on Iran stopping nuclear research work is actually lifted in about 10 years. It means that the deal, which was premised on the fact that we stop them from getting a bomb by about a year, putting them away from it for about a year, within the restrictions being pulled off, they could almost instantaneously get to a nuclear weapon within 6 months, and they can produce new centrifuges that spin the uranium and enrich it, and advanced ones that do that even quicker. So that's what we're dealing with here, and we have a document now proving it.
Do you think that this is going to be something that could be a problem for Hillary Clinton? I mean, I know that the deal was signed when she had already left her role as Secretary of State, but as a part of the Obama administration and surely involved in the discussions about the Iranian program that the administration was having, as well as the early stages of these negotiations, is this the kind of thing that you think might pose a problem, or is it sort of a little too far in the future, obscure for people to really get that energized about it?
It's a combination of both. I can certainly tell you that it will pose a problem for Hillary in terms of the politics and the look of this. She is tied to this policy. Does she unravel what her predecessor did, a landmark achievement as far as the Obama administration considers it? Does she work to unravel that? Does she work to change it? I think that she certainly could. People in her camp have not necessarily been quiet about their criticism of the deal. So I think we could see some of the parameters change. And actually, to be perfectly honest with you, see her take a stronger hand towards the Iranians, their intransigence, their ballistic missile tests, these sorts of dangerous actions.
And what's the latest on there was a plot in Brazil that they think was broken up for Islamic State devotees, people who have pledged allegiance to the Islamic State, to attack the. Do you have any updates on this, or how real was this plot?
Right. Well, look, I have no breaking updates as far as I'm aware now, and it's a little bit tough because I'm here at the convention to follow it as closely as I'd like to, but I think this is part of a larger thing. This is not an isolated incident. ISIS, its terrorist supporters, are doing these types of actions all across the globe, and it's not just in the Middle East. The Iranians do this as well. The Iranians operate in Latin America. They operate virtually across the globe, and this is how you train and move terrorists. In the same vein, we saw just a couple days ago, the Obama administration put sanctions on three top Al-Qaeda members who were moving money and terrorist forces. Where were they hiding out? Where are they hiding out? In Iran. They're being fostered there, and they're actually working with the Iranian government. So let's not fool ourselves to think that terrorism and ISIS and the Iranian terrorism is just in an isolated region. It's actually across the globe.
One more for you before we let you get back to all the craziness of the convention. How's the security situation and the protesters and all that been, by the way? I haven't gotten to that today. People were really concerned about that. I know there were some urine water balloon fights that had happened, from what I understand.
Yeah.
But what's the latest on all that stuff?
Well, look, I think that's a great question, because this is a conversation that I've had privately with multiple people. It keeps coming up, the security. I'll be perfectly honest with you. Yes, security is tight, but I don't sense a difference in terms of any other convention. Security is always tight at these events because they're a target, whether it's for protesters, whether it's for terrorism. It's a security liability. So I wouldn't say security is more tight, but there is an underlying tension and nervousness that people have. And, of course, these protesters, I saw in the Washington Post, like you said, carrying bags of urine, which apparently are not banned because there's, in the rules, no prohibition on bags of urine.
That's a very lawyerly approach to disgusting protesters. But I suppose I guess they pay attention to these things. Adam Credo is a senior writer for foreign policy and national security at the Free Beacon. Are you going to be filing later today, or when can we expect the latest Credo opus?
I will be filing actually later this afternoon. I started on it just before we began speaking, and it's going to focus on how the Iranians are actually responding to the new UN reports that show them to technically be violating the nuclear agreement. Will there be repercussions? I don't know, but the Iranians are actually threatening to just full out restart their nuke program now.
Oh, wouldn't that be interesting, right in the height of election season? They just decide
exactly
to start spinning those centrifuges. Spin, baby, spin. Yeah, that would change things up, I think, pretty quickly. Adam Credo, great to have you as always. Thank you for giving us some time today.
Always my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Team, phone lines open 888-900-3393. Jeremy in North Carolina, what is up, sir?
Yeah, Buck. Just wanted to weigh in on the crew speech, because I think a lot of people are giving Ted Cruz not enough credit. I'm definitely a Cruz supporter, but I'm also a never Hillary. I think Ted Cruz knew that it was going to be, for lack of better words, political suicide, what he said last night. But that being said, I think what he wanted to stress was that people do need to get out and vote, regardless of whether or not you're going to vote for Hillary or Trump. I left you a message on Facebook about this, but basically he fell in on his sword of the Never Trump movement, because had he endorsed Trump, I think a lot of the Never Trumpers would have just absolutely stayed home and not voted at all. But by throwing himself on the sword, he was able to possibly motivate the Never Trumpers to actually go out and vote. Even if they don't vote for Trump, they're going to go out and vote now. And I really think Cruz is really getting hammered unfairly.
Okay, well, I think that's a very interesting line of analysis. Makes sense to me that certainly the points about how Cruz doesn't want people to stay home. And, you know, that's, you know, it's like that old thing that people say, you know, you don't vote, you don't complain. You know what I mean? I mean, if you're going to stay home entirely, then I don't understand why. You know, if you're going to stay home entirely, then you're going to get the government that you get. And, you know, each of us can only do our part in this. But if you're not going to do your part and cast your vote based on your conscience or based on whatever your deciding mechanisms may be, I think that's obviously a very, very bad sign. I think that would be a bad choice. Okay. I mean, that's interesting. You also may get a fair amount of people who, once they're in the, I see the point that if Cruz had endorsed Trump, he would have lost so much credibility with Never Trumpers, and who are primarily, I believe, Cruz supporters. And most of the Never Trumpers that I know certainly are Cruz supporters. And maybe that would have made them so disgusted that they just sat home from the whole process. Whereas by saying that going out and voting, that you should at least go out and vote, one, that protects the down ballot candidates. OK. And two, maybe a fair amount of the Cruz people, when push comes to shove, they're there in the election booth. You know, they may hold their nose, or their voting booth, they may hold their nose and just say, all right, I'll vote for this guy. So, I mean, OK. Jeremy, I think those are all fair points. I think that's, that's fair enough.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. See, I'm open to it. You know, people are getting so mad at me. I'm like, I was a Cruz supporter, but I can't be a Cruz supporter in terms of this election right now. What do people want me to do? What am I supposed to do? What's going to make people happy? Last night was awesome. Cruz is a genius. He's wonderful. He's going to win in 2020. Okay, great. Sure. What do we do now? What do we do for the next 3 or 4 months? That's all I just want someone to tell me. What is a principled constitutional conservative do between now and Election Day? Vote down ballot and let Hillary Clinton win? All right, let's just say that then, if that's what we do. Hillary gets to be president, and we vote for everybody else that's a conservative on the ticket, and we maintain our principles, and we live to fight another day. That's okay. But let's say that then, right? Let's just say that. Let's not say that, oh, you know, we don't want Hillary to win, but we can't vote for Trump. It's like, well, I don't want Hillary to win either. I don't really get excited about the idea of Trump winning, but I don't understand how this is controversial, but it is apparently somewhat controversial. I would also say, and you know, some of you are going to get mad. I can hear like Cruz at the end of his speech. I can hear some of the boos right now. You can go check out Hillary Clinton's official Twitter account. She had, as of last night, almost 11,000 retweets of it. Vote your conscience, HillaryClinton.com/vote. So, okay. Hillary Clinton using Ted Cruz's words as essentially an endorsement of voting for her. And you can say that, you know, that's spin and it's slippery and whatever, but Hillary Clinton clearly took it as an opening for her campaign. Vote your conscience, vote for Hillary. Because the implication of vote your conscience from that stage was clear. You know, we can argue about a lot of things. I don't think that's really arguable. By the way, Cruz has left open the possibility, as I understand it, as reported this morning, of endorsing Trump later, depending on what Trump says. And I just wonder if all the people who are telling me now that emailing me to say that I'm a sellout because I don't want Hillary to win, if in fact Cruz in the end does endorse Trump, do I get apologies if Cruz goes? I'm just wondering. Or is that no? Okay. The other side of this I'd also point out to you is I'm old enough to remember and, you know, honest enough to say that I remember when Cruz and Trump were buddy-buddy. Do you remember that during the primary? Saying very nice things about each other. Cruz thought that that was politically expedient at the time. It's what he did. There's a very real argument to be made that if Cruz from the beginning, when all the things about Trump's flip-flopping and lack of principle and lack of everything else, from the beginning, if he had a unified message with others against Trump, maybe they could have stopped this. Maybe Cruz would have been the nominee. But Cruz played politics. He's a politician. He was very nice to Trump at the beginning. That's not up for discussion, really. He was. I remember that. So was he a sellout then? Oh, he just didn't know that Donald Trump was all the things that we know about him? Let's keep it real, everybody. I'm keeping it real. Because I'm keeping it real. Like, what's the guy's name from Clueless? I can't remember now. But he's very good in that role. Sponsor this half hour, my friends, is Silencer Shop. Look, Silencer Shop has all of the best brands possible. Silencer Shop is the best place for you to go right now to get the best prices, the widest selection, and also, critically, if you're somebody who's out there to buy a silencer, they make the whole process of getting a silencer as easy as it can be. They'll walk you through step by step. You go on the site, you read testimonials, you watch the videos, and they will help you get through the process. So if you want to have a more enjoyable shooting experience, you want to be out at the range, you want to make sure that you're getting the most you can out of your time exercising your Second Amendment rights. A silencer is a great addition to your kit at home. It's a fantastic thing for you to have. And Silencer Shop will make the whole thing easier. So go to silencershop.com right now. You can check them all out right there, silencershop.com. Again, that is silencershop.com. Help make the world a quieter place, team. We'll be right back.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
The Blaze Radio Network.
You're listening to the Buck Sexton Show.
Taking some calls here, team, 888-900-3393. I think we'll also put up a poll to get your sense of what you thought about last night's speech. Maybe you can tell me what you think of the RNC overall. Jess in Denver, you're on the Buck Sexton Show. Welcome.
Hi, Buck. First, I just want to tell you, first up, I'm loving the new format of your show. I think you're increasing some of your guests and things, and they're just awesome, and I'm loving it.
Thank you.
Yes, I'd like to just kind of go over a list that I've been making while I've been waiting, and you pick what you want to chew on. First of all, I think what Cruz did keeps Trump's feet to the fire. He hasn't done anything much for us conservatives. Picking Pence was okay, but I'd like to hear a whole lot more from him in order for him to get my vote. When Cruz told me vote my conscience, that sure as heck does not mean vote for Hillary Clinton. I don't know how anybody who's Republican can take that way. Then the last thing, if he had come out and just like, I endorse Trump, you know, blah, blah, after all that had gone on in this election and all the mudslinging and the lack of any type of I'm sorry from Trump or anything like that, he would have been exactly what the Trumpsters accused him of being, establishment. And lastly, Kasich and Rubio and Carly, why aren't they getting criticized for not coming in his camp? I just feel like the Republican establishment, such as Mary Kissel from the Wall Street Journal, went ballistic on a radio show that's very popular in New York that you're familiar with, blaming Cruz and Green Eggs and Ham, you know, et cetera, for what happened with the Republican Party and its separation of the establishment from the Republican base. And I think that's just funny. It's not realistic, again, on their part. I think he does have a green eggs and ham moment. Again, he stood. He's got a lot of people ticked off, but he stood on principles. Dude, that's who the guy is. So I'm going to just kind of be quiet and let you take it from there, Buck. Thank you.
No, Jess, that's an many excellent points. And, again, there are some times, Jess, where if someone called in, I would say, you know, I really think you're wrong. And this isn't one of those times. I'm working through this just like everybody else. I'm telling you where I am on this stuff right now, not, well, other people are wrong. I'm not saying to anybody they're wrong. I'm just asking for help. I'm asking for advice. I'm asking for thoughts. And you just shared some very excellent ones with me. So, Jess, I appreciate that. Thank you for calling in from Denver. Did we lose Jess? She was such a nice caller. Okay, more coming, team.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network. Buck Sexton, the Blaze Radio Network.
Everybody, we're joined now by Charles Cook. He is the editor-in-chief of National Review Online. Charles, great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Charles, we've been talking a lot about it. We've hit on a couple of other things, too. But I wanted to get your sense of what went down last night at the RNC. Obviously, you're the guy running the show over at NRO. NRO has been very staunchly anti-Trump for quite a while now. What do you think about all this?
In hindsight, I suppose it was inevitable. I did raise an eyebrow when I saw that Ted Cruz had been given such a prominent speaking slot. The question was, how brave would he be? It seems quite brave. I dare say that speech, when on paper, could just about have passed as an endorsement or something close to it. But the way that Cruz delivered it, the places he chose to pause, the emphases he chose to make, made his view clear. He has plausible deniability this morning. He can say, look, I was just making my case. I always said I wouldn't endorse him. But there was an edge last night to what Cruz said, and it's an edge that didn't come from nowhere. It's an edge that is felt by many people, myself included, that Donald Trump is an imposter, that Donald Trump is not a conservative, that Donald Trump is going to lose to Hillary Clinton, and maybe deserves to lose to Hillary Clinton. I think it was extremely dramatic, and I suppose it was always going to be. There was always going to be something, and Ted Cruz delivered it rather than the delegates.
Now, without in any way, Charles, trying to pose this question to you in a way that, and it's hard not to, without it sounding like anyone who was asked this question is being put in a position that's sort of unwinnable, and perhaps the tone of it, the implication can be kind of snide. But I ask you in all good faith, for conservatives who feel that way, and by the way, I would not want to be on the other side of a debate where the question posed was, is Donald Trump a conservative? That's not a debate that I could win, nor is it one that I would want to have, because I don't think he is. But if taking all of this as true, and if what Ted did last night was brave, you know, obviously his detractors are saying that it was very calculated, and they're calling it selfish, but that's whatever. Neither here nor there to the question I'm about to ask you. Why shouldn't conservatives come out and say we'd rather Hillary Clinton win at this point? I'm kind of missing that step.
Well, I think because they don't feel like that. I think the problem here is that many conservatives feel that both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are unqualified for the office. I think many conservatives also feel that there is no guarantee that Trump will be better. Now, I think Trump has perhaps gone some way to assuaging those fears by choosing Mike Pence, and also by making it clear that his vice president, should he be elected, will have a lot of power. But this is a guy who told the New York Times yesterday that he would consider how the countries in NATO had treated the United States or what contributions they'd made before coming to their aid. This is a guy who said yesterday that the United States should not be lecturing people around the world, should not be explaining the importance of freedom because it has its own problems here at home, which is a line that we've typically heard either from the Soviets or from those who like to talk America down, for example, President Obama. And if you believe, as I do, that Donald Trump is a man of low character, that he's unpredictable, that he cares about very little except himself, it also seems possible that were he to make it to the White House, he would set conservatism and the right back for a generation. So the answer to your question is that I don't know. I don't know. This is an impossible position to be in. There is absolutely no circumstance in which I would support Hillary Clinton or vote for Hillary Clinton or advocate for Hillary Clinton or go out onto the street and speak favorably about Hillary Clinton. But it does seem to me that we have a huge problem because our alternative is a disaster.
I don't disagree with any of that. I that's why I feel like I'm trying to work through an impossible position here. While keeping in mind that there's going to be an election and someone's going to be the president, and there are consequences to the decisions both made by people who have platforms and followings and are able to persuade many of their fellow citizens to vote one way or another, as well as each and every one of us as an individual. I don't want to divert from this too much, Charles, but I just also wanted to say I think it's interesting about all of the sort of gnashing of teeth or all of the sort of scary, oh my gosh, what are we going to do about Trump with NATO? Which, by the way, his comments on NATO just come from somebody who I think doesn't really have an understanding of the purpose or history of NATO.
Huge problem.
Right, which is a huge problem. But I just also think it's worth pointing out that, for example, with Ukraine, we were part of a binding agreement to defend Ukraine. It wasn't a NATO agreement, but we said we promised Ukrainians, hey, if you give up your nuclear weapons, we will defend you. And under this administration, they're like, well, I mean, that doesn't really mean we're going to defend you. So not quite as important or powerful.
That's absolutely true. But of course, conservatives, including me, and including you, pointed that out, slammed the Obama administration for it, and argued, I think correctly, that it's exactly that sort of abdication of responsibility that makes the world less safe. So although it is galling to watch progressives today slamming Trump, having praised Obama for his poise and his restraint and his thoughtfulness, I don't want us to enter into the same sort of hypocritical territory. Donald Trump may well not know what he's talking about, and that's probably better than his being calculated. But I still think that it's a big problem, and I think if I were an ally of the United States, not so much Britain or France, but if I were an ally, especially in Eastern Europe, where they're already worried by Brexit, which I supported, but they are worried that the one sane voice within the EU is going to retrench, then I would be a little alarmed hearing what I'm hearing from somebody who may be the next president of the United States. And I think conservatives should point that out.
Yeah, he does have his immediate reaction to any policy question, from what I've seen, where he clearly doesn't have a depth of understanding, which is a lot of policy questions, if we're going to just be truthful about it. But the immediate reaction is always sort of retreat into a transactional view of all things, right? What have they, sort of a what have you done for me lately, or, you know,
right.
You know, and that's not, especially on national security issues, that's not the way, you know, American. The American umbrella of military protection is not some sort of glorified mercenary army where, you know, if a country is paying enough into an alliance or if they're providing enough, we'll defend them. And if they don't, we won't. So, I mean, I think it's a completely fair criticism. I just think it's funny that many of the main media outlets that are posing this as, oh, my gosh, the NATO alliance, you know, the Western world is coming apart with Russia's egregious seizures of territory in Ukraine, its aggressions in Ukraine, its aggressions elsewhere as well, but specifically in a country that we had committed in writing to and put the U.S.'s good name behind that agreement. The Obama administration's like, yeah, whatever, just a piece of paper. So, you know, I think it's funny, and you, we agree on that, and I don't need to get too much more into that. I just, last night as I was reading some of the responses to that interview with, it was, of course, a New York Times interview with Trump, I thought, wow, there's just the amount of gall, the cheekiness here. To borrow from your folks, Charles, the cheekiness is astonishing. But now we get to the point of so going into tonight, I mean, I sort of want to know, what about the argument that conservatives should be doing everything they can to try to shape Trump's both message and possible presidency as opposed to retreating from it? Is it just for you just too far gone? It's like telling somebody, you know, hey, you know, the patient's already, you know, the patient's already been sent to the, you know, is already finished with. We can't do anything for him, but let's just bring out the electrical paddles and try. I mean, what are we, you know, this campaign, is it just too far gone? Is that the argument?
I don't know. It does seem possible that he could be open to reason. It does seem possible that he could be advisable. It does seem possible that he could be prevailed upon. I've said for a long time that it's extraordinary to me that Donald Trump came along and played the role that he has when he could have put forward a message. It wouldn't have been my message. It's not really my politics. But a message that would probably have won this election. If he had come along from the first instance and said, trade's fine, I am a businessman, I engage in trade, but it's really hurting people in Pennsylvania and Ohio. If he'd said, immigration's fine, I married an immigrant, of course I like immigrants, but blacks and Hispanics and poor whites are having their wages depressed by illegal immigration and unchecked immigration of low-skilled workers, we need to do something about it. If he'd said, I understand the need to be kind to people, but political correctness is stifling our culture, and so on and so forth. He could have been bombastic. He could have been brusque. He could have had an edge. But he wouldn't have been talking about Megyn Kelly in the way he did. He wouldn't have been saying Hispanics were rapists. He wouldn't have made the comments that he did about John McCain. He could have been a contender, to borrow a line from On the Waterfront. And unfortunately, he didn't do that. And what that says to me is that this isn't just about Donald Trump as a politician or as a thinker. Is that there is something about Donald Trump's character that is unstable and undesirable. And that's what worries me more than anything. Yes, he could sit down every day with Mike Pence, receive a great briefing, and come out and surprise us all. He could be articulate and responsible. But there's something about Donald Trump that seems off. And I can't get past that, I'm afraid.
So where does that leave you, if I may ask, Charles? Are you in – look, it is Ted Cruz's position that he still may endorse Donald Trump depending on what Trump does going forward. I believe that's his official – Cruz is not never Trump. He's not yet, and not unless things change dramatically. I think that's a kind of a fair approximation of his position. So for someone like you who's been very forthright and stated your principles and stuck to them this whole time on this issue – going in, are you in wait and see, or are you going to go and vote and decide that, you know, or you know, what? You're going to vote down ballot? What are you going to do?
Well, I should say, for full disclosure, I can't vote till next year.
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot. Yeah, yeah.
Well, but I think that has slightly informed me in that I can avoid having to make difficult decisions. So there's a note against myself. Were I able to vote, I would certainly vote Republican down ballot, especially this year. I think that I would really struggle to know what to do. I mean, obviously, there are circumstances in which I would change my mind and say, well, we'll just have to go with Donald Trump. But there are also circumstances in which I would do that for Hillary Clinton. If Hillary Clinton said, for example, the Second Amendment protects an individual right, abortion is bad, I don't like Obama's foreign policy, well, yeah, sure, I'd back her. That's unlikely to happen. And at the moment, I think it's unlikely that Trump is going to change enough. But of course, there are circumstances in which I would change my mind. As the facts change, so would I. At the moment, though, I think it's more of a threshold question. I don't think either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton come up to the threshold.
All right. Well, there we have it. Charles, when can we expect your next piece up on National Review?
Well, something will probably happen and irritate me, and I'll throw it up. I had a couple up yesterday, especially in the evening. The Massachusetts Attorney General unilaterally rewrote the state's gun control laws. So if you go to National Review and read about that, that will annoy you.
All right, I will do so. So let's all hope that something else annoys Charles so we can see him take an issue apart again soon. But Charles, editor-in-chief of National Review, Charles Cook, National Review Online, appreciate you giving us time. As always, Charles, great to have you here.
Thanks for having me. Talk to you soon.
More coming, team. Stay with me.
Buck Sexton, The Blaze Radio Network.
All right, team, we've got David in Idaho. David, you're on the Buck Sexton Show. Welcome.
Hi, Buck. Thanks for taking my call. How are you?
Good. Thank you for calling in.
Yes, I thank you also for having Charles on. I really think he's got some interesting points. You know, I wanted to see if this makes sense and resonates with you at all. And that is, I think for us deep conservatives, the way that Donald Trump handled himself to get to where he is seems to be something that violates one of our core principles, whether it's the end justifies the means that we can't stand in progressives, or whether it's this Saul Alinsky tactic, which he used viciously on Ted Cruz, polarizing him as a Canadian, going after his wife, making up lies about his father and letting him go unfettered, being in a situation where you call someone a liar thousands of times. And I don't understand why we continually point back to what Ted's doing, because it's almost like, since our guy used the Alinsky tactic and our guy got nominated, let's get behind our guy. And that's not what we're about. Even if you're saying, gee, the balance of the country is in play because of Hillary, why would we violate the things that we have railed against, progressives forever? Even your boss, Glenn Beck, has pioneered that process. And yet we continue to say, gee, Ted did this, Ted did that. All Donald would have had to have done is made a public apology statement saying, look, in the heat of the campaign, I said and did things that impugned a really classy, very smart guy. Ted Cruz is by far the smartest person who's ever ran for office, probably since Woodrow Wilson, who was evil in his way of running. And I think that we've pointed this finger at Ted Cruz in a way that's almost silly because it doesn't match who we are. Democrat and crossover half-wit people voted for Donald Trump to get him in those first three or four primaries. These crossover voting situations did not represent Americans who are considered conservative Republicans.
All right, David, we're at time, but thank you, sir.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Only on the Blaze Radio Network. Spreading freedom across the nation. This is
the Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome to Hour 3 in the Freedom Hut. Get ready for another long exposition on everything that Ted Cruz said. I'm just kidding. It's a Buck Brief. Stay.
You are entering the Blaze Threat Ops Center. This is a secure space. All outside comms are down. Prepare to receive the Buck Brief.
The latest stats on Turkey and what has happened there in the aftermath of a coup that was quite short-lived and, as many have pointed out, had almost no chance of success given the numbers of people involved, the size of the Turkish state, the requirements of what would have been needed in order to overcome AKP, Erdogan sympathizers, people who actually hate Erdogan and yet support the system. What would have been required to get over and around all of that was many times more than anything that was seen. You have a couple of hundred people dead. And now the pendulum swings in the other direction. Erdogan is still in power. The coup was unsuccessful, as you know. We've talked about it. Here's the BBC reporting on the purge that has occurred after this. Keep in mind, talking about maybe a battalion-level incident here in terms of how many people tried to overthrow the Turkish government. I mean, it was not a couple of battalions, maybe, and it was not a huge number of people that were involved in the coup, and yet what you see now is a classic case in the consolidation of power. BBC reporting that 6,000 military personnel have been arrested. Two dozen generals awaiting trial. Remember, Erdogan has said that he might bring back the death penalty because of what's happened here. So we may have trials and executions of coup plotters. Nearly 9,000 police officers have been sacked. Close to 3,000 judges have been suspended. 1,500 employees of Turkey's finance ministry have been dismissed. 492 people have been fired from the Religious Affairs Directorate. And now we also have more reporting on people being kicked out of the education sector. 15,000 education staff in Turkey have been suspended after last week's failed coup. So this is an out-and-out house cleaning of the Turkish government by Erdogan. Now, keep in mind, whatever one thinks of this coup, the notion that somehow the Turkish government was able to gather all this information on all of these people after the coup, of course, is preposterous. The Turkish government had to already, the ruling party in Turkey, I should say, because remember, we had our discussion before about the Turkish deep state. We may have had that discussion the same week that the deep state rose out of the depths in order to try and overthrow a democratically elected but very undemocratic in his method of rule, President Erdogan. So, I mean, people are saying, Buck, is that a coincidence? I can neither confirm nor deny. You know, do I know peeps who know peeps? Maybe. Was it just a interesting coincidence that we're talking about the Turkish deep state the same week that the deep state, for the first time in decades, tries to reach up and pull down the president of this very large and important NATO ally? I don't know. I leave that for you, my friends. But I do know that the Turkish deep state, such as it had existed, is probably no more, will never exist, or at least is not likely to exist in quite the same way going forward. And Erdogan, who has been Islamizing, and just by the way, for the purposes of your own, just go and check online and look at Erdogan's palace, which I believe is three times the size of Versailles, and his sort of personal guard and how they dress up. And you look at this individual, and the creation of a cult of personality around him is very obvious. The sort of stuff that you would expect, yes, from a Putin, but even some of it even starts to stray more into the realm of like a Kim Jong-un or Kim Jong-il or Kim Il-sung. It starts to feel a little more like he is positioning himself as even more than a government figure based on the way that he operates, and certainly is very anti-freedom of the press. I've mentioned to you before, the Turkish government is one of the worst offenders in the world when it comes to freedom of the press. And it's one of the worst places to be a journalist. And that's including all sorts of countries where there are tremendous restrictions on the press. But in Turkey, they're actually jailing, they're imprisoning people for this. There are other places where I suppose you could just say, well, it's all known that if you did certain things, if you say certain things, you'll be jailed, and so people don't do it. In Turkey, there was the pretense of a free press before, and that is increasingly a fiction. And so with this purge, though, you're going to have a very different Turkish state. By the way, I've mentioned this to you before, a classic Islamist strategy is control education sector. I've mentioned this in the context of the book Submission, which Michelle Ulbeck, I've talked to you about it before, which is kind of funky and weird in some places, but it's about how France could essentially become an Islamist state with the Muslim Brotherhood, a part of a coalition government, and then a lot of money pouring in from the Gulf. And just looking at the playbook as it's been instituted elsewhere and in the context of – and this is a novel, granted, but it's a novel that has some very obvious roots in what has happened elsewhere. And with that in mind, you look at what the Muslim Brotherhood always wants. They want control of education because they understand that they can always create a short-term policy of supporting democracy and human rights and minority protections and all this other stuff. As long as they control the mindset of a majority of the population, they can get whatever they want, and then they can go back on all that stuff. Because the Muslim Brotherhood, by definition, because it's Islamist, it believes that Islam is determined by, it is in fact dictated by, or that rather politics is dictated by Islam. And you have no source of authenticity, there's nothing other than Islam, both for the creation of law and for the implementation of the state's will. And so then it's just a question of interpreting how this, how Islam, essentially what would Islam do here? What would Islam mean here? And that doesn't change just because there are elections. And with Erdogan, you see this rising up of what's been known for a long time, which is that outside of the major cities, outside of Istanbul, outside of Ankara, the people in the Turkish countryside are much more religious. Many more women cover much more, right? And that's one of the most obvious manifestations because it's so visual and so clear. It's visual and so clear to all of us that somebody is more religious, right? I mean, you never meet somebody who wears a full burqa and was walking around. I mean, people say in Saudi they're forced to. Okay, fine. You don't meet anyone who chooses to wear a full burqa and then wants to go and drink and party and talk about women's rights and is pro-gay rights and whatever. You don't. I'm sure it exists. And somebody says, oh, no, I know someone. But generally speaking, the way a woman chooses to dress in Islam. And this is true of men as well, by the way. You're not going to meet a guy who's walking around in a thobe, which is a sort of long Saudi robe-like garment. In Afghanistan, there's a shirt that's very long. It sort of looks like a nightshirt, maybe trying to be a little saucy there, but it looks like a nightshirt. They call it a galabiya. So that's if somebody's walking around with that, that's more cultural. But if someone's walking around in a country like Turkey and they're wearing a full thobe, I mean, essentially, if they're walking around, they look like a guy who dresses in Saudi Arabia. And this is true of more hardline imams as well, and also the length of the beard. And these are visual manifestations of religiosity. That red henna beard. There's also the sort of showy, oh, look at me, I have a a prayer mark on my forehead, another thing to look for in these cases. And when somebody has that prayer mark, it is an indication of how religious they are, right? Because that means you're praying five times a day and really pressing your forehead against the ground when you're down on your knees facing east towards Mecca, or facing towards Mecca. For us, it's east here. Obviously, not always east. Depends on where you are. But that's been bubbling up, and we've always had this. I find it very interesting, too, by the way, because as somebody who goes on TV and is willing to be critical of what's going on in the Islamic world in a way that other people will not, the fact of the matter is that they always point to Turkey and they say, well, look at how modern and how secular and how great Turkey is. And it's like, yeah, it works that way because there are people who are not particularly religious who have the guns, and they stop the really religious people from taking over. That's a sort of a shortened version of what has been the case in Turkey. So they talk about how, look, Islam and democracy can coexist. Islam and democracy can coexist in Turkey as long as there are people who don't allow Islam to overtake and destroy democracy, and those people have the guns. Then it works. People say, well, Buck, aren't they Muslims too? Well, yeah, but they're along the sort of more nominal, more secular Muslims, the ones who were in charge of the military previously, the ones who would go forward and prevent an Islamization of the country overall. And look, this is a country that's under this current government, very favorable towards Hamas, towards the Muslim Brotherhood, towards other Islamic hardliner groups. Now, some of this, of course, and I'm sure if we had an apologist for Erdogan to come on air, which we could find, wouldn't be that hard. Some of this is clearly a result of Erdogan just consolidating his domestic power base. But I think it's also a recognition of which way the winds are blowing in Turkey. Keep in mind, you have a lot of refugees from Syria who have come into Turkey. You have a very different perspective given in much of the Muslim world on all of the Muslim world on U.S. and Western foreign policy and more importantly, military action in the region. You know, we see it as, well, we're bombing ISIS. You know, turn on Al Jazeera sometime, and what you see is, oh, okay, you mean that we're just killing women and children for no reason in Syria and Iraq. I mean, that's really the impression you're meant to get from that. And that's, of course, purposeful on the part of the way Al Jazeera depicts these things. But that has real consequences for the way people vote, for the way people think, for the way people live their lives in some of these countries, because they're under the impression that we're the bad guys. And you can imagine that if you're particularly religious and you think America is part of some imperial crusader venture in trying to just prop up Israel at the expense of everything else and trying to destroy Islam, and that's reinforced by these images of what's going on in Iraq and Syria and else. And by the way, they'll always, even if we're doing nothing in Iraq and Syria, they'll just show video of Palestinian refugee camps or, you know, whatever. They'll always have some means of striking this chord and agitating further with people. So that's sort of the part of the dynamic that goes on over there that I think people don't really understand. And my friends – and I was getting live updates from a friend in Turkey during the coup about what was happening, about the gunfire and about, you know, hearing jets and everything. The people living in the major cities – aren't representative, and certainly the intellectual class and the elites aren't representative of opinion outside, just like you could say is true in this country. And sometimes the divide is quite wide on a lot of these things. So back to the sort of the post-coup cleanup that's underway right now, what you see is that there's really nothing to stand in Erdogan's way when it comes to consolidating under this Islamist banner, and this is going to be a big problem. This is going to be a big problem for us. They are the gateway for refugees into Europe. If they're not willing to sort of be helpful, and they weren't very helpful on their own, although the Europeans were kind of asking for it. But if they're not willing to be helpful on the Iraq too, to some degree, but on the Syrian border, that makes the conflict with the Islamic State much worse. If we can't use Incirlik Air Base for any number of missions and air campaigns. We have a lot of air assets there. This changes the game very quickly if there is all of a sudden a government in charge in Turkey that's really not that favorable to Western interests and stability. And, you know, we talk about NATO and the Trump comments about the NATO alliance and whether he would go to war to defend one of the Balkan states. By the way, I don't always – I'm not as definitive as a lot of other people on whether Obama would go – you know, if Russia invaded the Baltics tomorrow, you think Obama would send in the armor and say, let's go? And, you know, if the Russians don't move, we're going to fire? I don't know if that's true. I'd be very curious to see that. When has Obama ever sort of sent in the cavalry, so to speak, for anything? People say the Bin Laden raid. Okay, that was a special forces, special operations raid, a precision targeted raid against a handful of people. Very, you know, very dangerous raid. I get all of that, but it wasn't about to. I don't think anybody believed it was risking a broader conflict. I don't think anyone thought the Pakistanis weren't going to, you know, start dropping bombs against our embassies or anything. At least the Pakistani government wasn't going to do that. So anyway, I'm not as sure as everybody else on that. But what's going on here in Turkey is fascinating. It's straight out of the playbook. It is eliminating dissent. It's using this crisis, which I do think was kind of the last gasp of the Turkish deep state against this Erdogan government, using it as a means of creating power that is beyond question, right? Power that cannot be questioned. And so we will have to see how this continues to shake out. 888-900-3393. If you have thoughts on this or anything else, lines are open. Also on Facebook.com/BuckSexton, and you can tell me your thoughts on stuff there too. More coming up. I'll be right back.
This is the Buck Sexton Show
on the Blaze Radio Network.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
We got Tom calling in from New York City. Tom, you're on the Buck Sexton Show. What's up?
How you doing, Buck? Thanks for taking my call. Real quick, I'm just wondering, because I'm a big Ted Cruz fan, okay? I'm just thinking ahead to 2020. If Donald Trump wins, am I obligated to support him in 2020?
You're not obligated to do anything. I mean, I think that's an improper form. I think that's not the right formulation of the question. You're not obligated to do anything. I mean, so what are you asking then beyond?
You know, only because what no, it's only happened once that an incumbent who sought re-election wasn't the nominee of his party.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if it seems like right now everybody's just because he has an R next to his name, I'm supposed to vote for Donald Trump. And if I don't, I'm a bad guy because I'm
I don't think anyone's. I mean, no one should. I mean, you're not a bad guy. I mean, I think the conversation I had with Charles Cook was pretty instructive about how both of we, you know, Charles and I both feel like this stinks. This is not fun. Not a fun choice. I'm not excited about it. I lean more towards supporting Trump. He leans more towards just, well, he can't vote, as he said. But if he could vote, he probably just would vote down ballot and wouldn't vote for Trump or Hillary. Okay. But, you know, I don't think anyone, no rational, reasonable person right now sits down with a fellow conservative and says, well, you know, you're a bad person because you're not. I never would say that. I don't know. I might come on here in a week and say, I'm going to do what Charles Cook says we should do. I might change my mind. I uphold that that's possible.
Okay. It seems like that's the mood that you're supposed to vote for this guy just because he's got an R next to his name.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe a better way to...
different.
Go ahead, sir. I didn't mean to interrupt you. What was that?
I'm sorry. I'm sure everybody has a threshold, if you will, of saying, you know, I draw the line here or there, to, you know, that I'm not just going to vote Republican because I'm registered as a Republican.
Sure. I mean, look, fine, people, you know, no one needs my permission for anything, right? And so if someone tells me that their position on this is that they want to vote down ballot and they're going to leave the president, the slot for president blank, fine. I mean, I think if enough people do that, it's obvious that if enough people in certain states do that, that's going to be helpful. And I know people don't like that, but what's the response to that? Yeah, it means Hillary Clinton's going to win. Okay, well, maybe that's what needs to happen for this country to get, you know, right and settled. I mean, Supreme Court will be gone for the next 30 years, but, you know, we can come back from that. We'll figure it out. We'll have the Congress, hopefully. I mean, it'll be tough for us to hold the Senate, but...
Yeah, that's something you're taking a chance. I mean, look, Obama's best friend has been Robertson. He was supposed to be on, you know,
Arthur, is who?
So to speak. Justice Roberts.
Oh, Justice John Roberts. Okay, yeah. I was like,
you
he's
know,
best
he
friends?
Who? He was supposed to be one of ours. You know, so you never know.
I hear you, Tom. Look, I appreciate your perspective, my friend. Thank you for calling. We got more coming up. Stay with me.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
Dispensing the truth. This is Buck Sexton
on the Blaze Radio Network.
All right, team, we're joined now by Michael Pregent. He's an adjunct fellow at the Hudson Institute, contributing writer at the Daily Beast. Michael, thanks for calling in.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it, Buck.
We were just talking about Turkey before you came on. So the clampdown is in full effect. The purges are underway. This is a deep and thorough effort to try and root out any elements that Erdogan views are disloyal, which is an interesting term. We can get into more of what that means
in a democracy.
Yeah. So tell me, what do you see happening here? What's really going on with post-coup Erdogan Turkey?
Well, initially, you know, the coup was touted as an undemocratic move to restore democracy because of what Erdogan was doing. Those of us that have worked with the Turkish military in the past were hoping it was pro-U.S. secular officers. It turned out to be a Gulen movement within the military. And Erdogan has used that as an excuse to, like you said, purge anyone disloyal. So it's not going to be limited to just simply the Gulen movement. It's going to be targeted against effective U.S. trained pro-U.S. secular military officers within the security and intelligence apparatus. They're even going after academia. They're even going after the media. I have friends in Turkey that have expressed concerns about their ability to write freely in the press, to criticize Erdogan. You can't do that anymore. And people that are calling this this coup against democracy are actually seeing a very undemocratic Erdogan in the aftermath.
Now, what do you think Erdogan's long game is here? Okay, so he's obviously trying to sort of Putinize Turkey even further, right, by making it's technically a democracy, but there's no institutions, there's no organs, there's no nothing to really effectively oppose. And so it turns into, if not a one party state, perhaps even a one man state. What does he want? What if Erdogan could do as he wished on foreign policy in areas where we have security concerns and we care, what would be different, if anything?
Erdogan's long game is to stay as long as he can in power. Erdogan is viewed as a very strong Muslim leader. He was able to shoot down a Russian aircraft and not face the consequences. He's been able to stand up to the West as a NATO member and not face the consequences. He's viewed as the one guy who's against Assad, against Iran, against Putin, and against the West. So there's that dynamic to the man's character. However, what he's doing with democratic institutions in his country is he's turning it into authoritarian rule. And he plans to stay as long as possible. It might be a Putin Medvedev type thing where if he does leave office, it'll just simply be one of his guys that he puts in place and he's still able to influence that. Unlike the United States, other countries, if you're out of power, you still exert a hell of a lot of influence on whoever's in power, especially if it's one of your guys.
Now, what does this mean for our efforts against the Islamic State? Do you see any change coming there? I mean, Erdogan's government's been pretty cozy with various Islamists, including Hamas. Do you think that this could be trouble, or it'll probably be business as usual for a while, at least, in the counterterrorism fights?
Well, we're still able to use Incirlik Air Base to conduct targeting against ISIS targets in Syria, even though we may be actually hitting non-ISIS targets as we continue to tilt toward the Russia and Iran position in Syria. Right now, the attack on the Istanbul airport was touted as one of the reasons the military, some in the military thought the coup might have some momentum. But now, after this, he sees domestic threats in Turkey have a higher priority than ISIS and higher priority maybe even than the Kurds right now. He's looking at political opponents. He's looking at members of his own party, members of the Gulen party, members of other opposition parties, member of secular nationalist parties, and he is making sure there are no threats from charismatic leaders or people of influence within Turkey. That's what seems to be happening. He should be condemned for it, especially as a NATO member.
Now, I also wanted to ask you about this piece that's in the – it's actually in the Washington Free Beacon about the U.S. sanctioning top al-Qaeda operatives working in Iran. This is the sort of thing – I think people would see this if you have sort of a casual casual attention paid to issues of counterterrorism. You're like, well, I mean, Iran is Shia. That's so weird. Tell people a bit about Iran's support and the Iranian – connections to Sunni jihadist terrorist groups, never mind groups like, Hezbollah. Well, I mean, Hamas, of course, is a Sunni group, so there's one, but Hezbollah and the Shia militias in Iraq and such. Iran is sort of an equal opportunity terrorist jihadist sponsor.
The Iranian Revolutionary Guard and its Quds Force make sure that they have ties into these different groups. So the al-Qaeda IRGC link predates the 9/11 attack. Iran facilitated the movement of key al-Qaeda leaders into Pakistan and Afghanistan at the request of Osama bin Laden. There were communiques between Osama bin Laden and his lieutenants. This was in the Washington Post, declassified. I'm not giving anything classified that actually said, hey, listen, do not attack Iran. They're one of our main supporters and main facilitators in the region. No one should be surprised that three top al-Qaeda leaders are in Iran and being sanctioned by the U.S. Treasury Department. If you're an Iranian leader, the safest place for you to be, a place where you will not get droned by U.S. Killer drones, is Iran, because this administration will do nothing to upset the Iran deal, meaning no actionable intelligence will generate a drone strike on an al-Qaeda operative if he is in Iran, and it's because of the Iran deal, and that is a sad state to be in.
I think this is important for everyone to keep in mind going forward, because the administration has done so much without even the Iranian regime, never mind meeting them halfway, making any effort whatsoever to placate U.S. Policies, sensibilities, or anything else in the region or anywhere for that matter. And I think we've sort of started to get bogged down into, well, there's a Sunni-Shia civil war going on in the Middle East more broadly, and Iran has sort of picked a side, and the Saudis, because they're Sunni, have picked a side. But the Iranians are a sort of unsinkable aircraft carrier for terrorist operations. And if they get nukes, then you'll have a large, wealthy state of 70 million plus people that has a nuclear umbrella that has ties into all the major jihadist terrorist groups all over the world, really.
Yeah, I mean, the Iran deal, the JCPOA, basically reactivated Iran's ability to use ships, shipping lines, companies, banks, individuals, to continue to export terrorism. And those were just the non-nuclear concessions. The nuclear concessions, you just saw the secret report that Reuters put out, where the breakout time for Iran is now 6 months, not a year. And Iran can actually start weaponizing its nuclear program in as early as 8 years. And that's if they don't cheat. And Iran has never not cheated.
And we're already hearing that Iran is cheating and there's side deals. And I mean, is there any doubt in your mind that Iran's long term goal is to go nuclear in terms of weapons, not just in terms of power?
Well, I mean, Ahmadinejad is so excited about Iran's future possibilities that he's doing everything he can to be able to undermine the, I'm putting moderate in quotations, Rouhani. Because he believes Iran will become a nuclear power at some point. But you and I both know, you being a former agency guy, and I, I worked with DIA and CENTCOM, is that there are probably about 20 analysts in the whole intelligence community that are looking at the Iranian nuclear program and aware of its cheating, but they're in a special access program. They have a very direct line of communication with the National Security Council and others to report any violations, and any reporting of that would be political suicide for the Iran deal. So everything is being politicized. The intel analysts are actually looking at Iran and know that Iran is cheating. Can't get that information out because it's so compartmentalized and only a certain amount of people are allowed to see it, that we wouldn't be aware of these violations if they were happening. At least the public wouldn't be. That's why you keep getting these leaks from Western intelligence agencies like the German intelligence agency.
But because there already is open, I mean, there's open source reporting. I mean, the news media is reporting on Iranian moves in this regard, and there's kind of a silence from the administration on it. And I suppose in their minds, they justify this by saying, well, we worked so hard to get this deal. It's the cornerstone of security in the Middle East. And I think that's how they view it.
And they said, well, you know, this deal wasn't meant to moderate Iranian behavior. We hear all the excuses. They concede all of our points that Iran is cheating, that Iran is dangerous. And then they make the argument, that's why we needed the Iran deal. It's a debate tactic 101 that's used by freshmen in college to impress women in bars. And it's pathetic when you're actually looking at this as a foreign policy novice or expert, when you see the blatant violations of UN Security Council resolutions and the blatant violations of the joint plan for whatever it's called, JPCOA, I almost call it something else.
Yeah, but look, I see this as one of the – it'll be one of the legacies of the Obama administration, that by the time anybody is able to make the case very openly and with all the facts that Iran has hoodwinked us and this was all doomed to failure from the start, the Obama administration will be long gone and there'll be people that just become apologists and say, oh, no, it's somebody else's fault for all this. One more before you go, Michael. I just want to ask you, where is the anti-ISIS campaign right now? What's the latest on our efforts, which – you know, I'll go on TV sometimes and I'll hear from other journalists, oh, the administration has ramped this up. It's very serious in Iraq and Syria. Okay, what are they doing right now?
Well, everyone was fair to criticize the president's delay. Criticize the president's delay in getting into the ISIS fight in Iraq and Syria. But now there's a rush, the Raqqa rush. So Ramadi was part of that rush. And now Mosul. And what we're doing, Buck, is we're creating a refugee crisis. We are pushing Sunnis out of their towns and sending them to refugee camps when those Sunnis should be intelligence sources and those Sunnis should be part of the ground force that's there to hold territory, to keep it from ISIS. We're resetting the conditions with this strategy. We're using a predominantly Shia force in Iraq and a predominantly Kurdish and Yazidi force in Syria. We're not bringing in the Sunnis needed to hold Raqqa and Deir ez-Zor and Manjib to keep it away from ISIS. We're using forces that are able to destroy, to clear, to kill, but it's causing a refugee crisis. If you use the Sunnis from those neighborhoods as intel sources and embedded them in the operations, you wouldn't have a refugee crisis because they'd be able to stay in their town and get it back to where it needs to be to keep ISIS out.
All right. Michael Pregent is a fellow at the Hudson Institute. He's also a contributing writer at the Daily Beast. Michael, always a pleasure to have you, sir. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Buck. Appreciate it.
Team, more coming. Stay with me.
Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network. The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
All right, team, I said I would take calls today. Let's take some more. We've got some up. Julianne in New Jersey, you're on the Buck Sexton Show.
Hey, Buck, Shieldsai.
Hey, Shieldsai, buddy.
Hey, you already had somebody touch on it before, but I figured I'd bring it up too. I've been on the fence for Donald Trump for a while because I'm a big Ted Cruz supporter, and I wasn't expecting him to endorse Donald Trump last night. But, I mean, for a guy that tells it like it is, I'd love to see Donald Trump just kind of like take a step back and say, you know what, I talked really bad about Ted Cruz's wife and maybe apologize a little bit. You know, a little humility would go a long way for me. And I was just wondering, what are your thoughts on that? Like, I'm so
yeah, of course,
to, like,
I think that Trump should have said. I mean, look, the retweeting of Heidi Cruz was disgusting, and he should have never done that. And his comments about Rafael Cruz were just. They were sort of – it's almost like when, like, Alex Jones says that I'm trying to take over American media as a CIA plant. Like, it's crazy to the point where it's hard to take it seriously. But in the context of a serious presidential campaign, you know, it was outrageous as well as crazy. So, yeah, he should have apologized. He shouldn't have said either one. So, yeah, sure. Yeah, I agree.
And, I mean, like, I've been, you know, going back and forth. And it seems like every time I get close, I'm like, all right, you know what? I'm going to pull the lever for Donald Trump. Something else comes out, and then I'm back to square one. And I, you know, so I'm glad that I'm listening to you, though, because I listen to Glenn, too, but he's a little too far, like, against Trump, and I'm more anti-Hillary, you know?
Yeah, look, I'm just trying to prevent Hillary Clinton from being your president for the next 8 years. That's my goal. Absolutely. Number one. And, you know, that it's not easy and it's not going to be fun. And I get all that, but that's my top priority. If people disagree with that as a priority, that's fine, too. But at least I'm honest about where I'm coming from on this stuff.
Yeah. And my last thing, you watch Game of Thrones, yeah?
I do.
Well, yes, yeah, I'm a big fan. Thinking back to season one, I mean, I don't know why. Am I going to spoil anything if I say something from season one, like when Ned Stark got, you know, he was the honorable guy, and it didn't work out so well for him. And, you know, that this whole political season kind of just reminds me of that.
All right, my friend. Well, thank you. What's your name, by the way?
Julian.
Julie. Okay. Thank you very much,
no,
sir.
No. It's Julian.
Julian. Oh, it's written as Julianne on my screen here. I'm like, I don't think that's his name.
Oh, my
okay.
God, brother. I guess
not that there's anything wrong with your, you know, with being Julianne, if that's a guy, but Julian, there we go. Julian from New Jersey. Thank you very much, sir. Bart, I see you've been on hold. We were going to get to you next, but we don't have time now. Call back tomorrow, Bart from South Carolina. We will get you on. We'll get you on quickly. Sorry about the wait. Hat tip to Bart for being a patient guy. We'll get you on tomorrow. Everybody, I appreciate you letting me work through all this stuff today. It's going to be an interesting night. We got Trump's convention speech. Ivanka is going to be speaking as well. We'll talk about other things, too, tomorrow, including I think we have maybe Milo joining to talk about getting suspended forever from Twitter. That'll be fun. Until tomorrow, everybody, shields high.
You're listening to Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network.